one who wishes to benefit sentient beings. Is that five? One, two, three, four, five. Yeah, that's five. And then the final part of that paraphrase, and those who have turned into persons of valid perception. Now, turned into a person of valid perception means turned into a person who has valid perception 100% of the time. And that is a Buddha. Remember, we said that we have valid perceptions almost 99, 99.5% of the time. And we do. But a Buddha has them all the time. A Buddha cannot have anything except valid perception. So the Buddha is another way of saying those who have turned into a person with valid perception. And remember now, Master Dignaga's talking about logic. He's talking about valid perception, about Sema. So we are going to use a sequence of four reasonings as we look at this verse. Now, this presentation that I'm going to give you is passed down in the oral tradition only. It's not in texts. Now, you have in your reading for this class an essay written by Ken Rinpoche. It was probably written at Geshe-la's request, but he goes through the four reasonings, which we're going to do now. So the four reasonings in the forward order examine and prove how one becomes a Buddha, or rather how one becomes one who is totally correct, who has valid perception all the time. Now, if we were to look at these reasonings in reverse order, then we would describe where a Buddha comes from. So one of the differences between forward order reasoning and reverse order reasoning is that the forward order reasoning tells us how to get somewhere or to arrive at some conclusion. A reverse order reasoning tells us how we got to where we were or how we established what we established. All right. So here's the first reasoning. This is called the reasoning of the protector. And it says, consider the teacher. He became totally correct because he is the protector. Now, teacher, what did Lord Buddha teach? Well, the first thing he taught was the four truths of Aryas. And we're especially concerned with the first one, the truth of suffering, you know. So we focus on that. Why? Because it agrees with our own experience. And that agreement leads us to understand that Lord Buddha only speaks the truth. Now, I've said that. We've talked about it. You have to establish that for yourself over, you know, a period of probably years. But you'll get there. Now, the truth of suffering is the only one of the four truths that we can confirm with our experience. Do we suffer? Yes. Okay. Do we suffer the suffering of suffering, which is medical, mental or physical pain? And the answer is yes, we do. We've had that experience. Do we experience the suffering of change, which basically is that any good experience we ever have comes to an end? Well, yes. We often don't call that a suffering, but it is a suffering, you know. Our goal is to be happy. And when we're happy, it's really nice, and then that goes away. So that's a sort of suffering. The happiness disappears. And then the third kind of suffering, which is this all-pervasive suffering, we probably don't think about much, but it's the fact that our entire life is either we either experience suffering or we're generating the causes to experience suffering. And that's basically what this all-pervasive suffering is. So by starting with the truth of suffering, Lord Buddha immediately establishes that he speaks the truth. Why? Because we understand what he's talking about. We can confirm that with our own experience. There's nothing in our experience that contradicts what Lord Buddha says about the truth of suffering. So he is, what do we call this? He is the protector, right? Now, it's interesting, the definition of protector in Tibetan is somebody who teaches. So a Buddhist speech is considered the highest form of activity, you know, even higher than activities of body and mind. The only way that a Buddha can protect us is by teaching us. So in order to accept this reasoning, we must already know these things. And young monks will have already learned them prior to studying this kind of logic, meaning they would know what a protector is. They would know what valid perception is, you know, totally correct and means valid perception all the time. And they would know what a teacher is. Now, this is sort of this course is an introduction to logic, so we're going to talk about this statement. Consider the teacher. He became totally correct because he is a protector. This is called in logic a syllogism. And a syllogism has three parts. It's got a subject, it has a predicate, and it has a reason. So what are these three parts in this syllogism? Consider the teacher. That's the subject. The thing we're talking about is the teacher. He became totally correct is the predicate. And the predicate is the thing that we want to prove. The link between the subject and the predicate is what we want to prove. Consider the teacher. He became totally correct, meaning teacher is totally correct. And then the reason is because he's the protector. So any syllogism is going to have these three parts. The reason is the thing that proves the link between the subject and the predicate. And if this is a little puzzling to you, hang on. You will begin to understand it as you become familiar with it. If you had logic in high school or college, university, you may have already studied this. And it's the same thing, basically, as Western logic. So that's the first forward reasoning. Consider the teacher. He became totally correct because he is the protector. Now, the second reasoning is the reasoning of having gone to bliss. Now, gone to bliss is one of the qualities of a Buddha. So consider the teacher. He is a protector because he has eliminated all bad qualities in himself. So a Buddha is a protector because he has gone to bliss, meaning that he has rid himself of all bad qualities. Now, someone who has gone to bliss, which is a code name, gone to bliss is a code name for a Buddha. Someone who has gone to bliss has eliminated all their bad qualities. Having eliminated all bad qualities gives that being the ability to protect all beings by teaching them. So he's a protector. Now, the bad qualities in this reason, refers to the inability to perceive all objects at the same time. As you're approaching Buddhahood, the first major thing that happens after direct perception of emptiness is that you remove all of your mental afflictions. Now, in the lower path, the lower vehicle, the Hinayana vehicle, once you remove all of your mental afflictions, you have reached nirvana. And that is the goal of the lower schools. Now, with Buddhahood, we want to become a Buddha, totally enlightened, so that we have omniscience and can help others. So after we've removed our mental afflictions, the next things that we do is remove what we call the obstacles to omniscience or knowledge obscurations. And those knowledge observations, the obstacles to omniscience, are what's referred to by the term bad qualities in the syllogism. Consider the teacher. He is a protector because he has eliminated all bad qualities, meaning all obstacles to omniscience, in himself. Now, the third reasoning is called the reasoning of the teacher. And teacher here refers to teacher of emptiness. Consider the teacher. He has gone to bliss because he teaches emptiness, which he has confirmed with his own perception. Now, this statement says, first of all, that one must perceive emptiness directly in order to go to bliss. Having seen emptiness directly, a Buddha has a tsema. He's got a valid perception of emptiness and teaches from that realization. Now, he had that realization way before he became a Buddha. The first thing that happens that really gets us going is a direct perception of emptiness. And after we've had that, we spend the rest of the path becoming very familiar with that. And by the time one reaches Buddhahood, you're ready to teach it. You know everything there is to know about it. Now, let's take a look at what we've got so far. The first syllogism says, consider the teacher. He became totally correct because he's a protector. The second one is consider the teacher. He became a protector, meaning now we're taking the reason from the first syllogism and using it as the predicate in the second syllogism. He's a protector because he's eliminated all bad qualities in himself. And the third one, consider the teacher. He's gone to bliss because he teaches emptiness. Now, eliminating all bad qualities is sort of the same thing as gone to bliss, because once you've eliminated all bad qualities, you've gone to bliss. You've become a Buddha. So he's gone to bliss because he teaches emptiness, which he's confirmed with his own perception. And that takes us now to the fourth reasoning, the reasoning of great compassion. And it goes like this. Consider the teacher. He is a teacher because he has great compassion. Now, what's the proof here? This is very interesting. Great compassion is the main cause of Buddhahood. Because of compassion, a Buddhahood teaches emptiness. The only way you can become a Buddha is through having great compassion. You decide for yourself that you want out of suffering and that you want to take everybody else out of suffering too. If you don't have great compassion, you can reach nirvana, which is what happens in the lower vehicle, the Hinayana vehicle. But you need great compassion in order then to traverse the steps between nirvana and Buddhahood. And that's what this one is saying. You know, consider the teacher. He is a teacher, meaning he teaches emptiness because he has great compassion. The great compassion was the driving force to get the person to complete the steps of the path in order to reach Buddhahood. Through teaching emptiness, he eliminates all his bad qualities, meaning he's gone to bliss. Now, a person doesn't start teaching emptiness until after they've become a Buddha. They do it before that. Teaching is one of the ways you generate the good karma to be able to progress on the path. Because of that, the Buddha is a protector, so we can go back in these steps too. Now, we're talking in this fourth reasoning about bodhicitta, this motivation to get ourselves enlightened so that we can help everybody else. Bodhicitta is the wish to become enlightened. Now, compassion is the feeling that you want to lift others out of suffering. That is contrasted in Buddhism with love. Love is wanting others to be happy. So these two things, they seem related, and they are, but compassion is the wish that others not suffer. And love is the wish for that others be happy. Compassion is Nyingje in Tibetan, and love is Jhampa in Tibetan. Now, Nyingje means literally Lord of the Heart. But it is a common word, meaning it's not honorific in Tibetan. So we use Tukje to refer to great compassion, the compassion that a bodhisattva has. Tuk is the honorific term for heart, whereas Ning is the honorific term for non-honorific term for heart in Tibetan. So Tukje is what we might call great compassion. We could also say, and you'll hear it, Nyingje Chenpo. Chenpo means great. So Nyingje Chenpo means great compassion. And it refers to the great compassion of an enlightened being. Tukje Chenpo, on the other hand, is the great compassion of a Buddha. So we can use Tukje, which means this wish to get enlightened, to help everybody else. It is perfected when one becomes a Buddha. And we can call it Tukje Chenpo, great compassion of a Buddha. Now, there are two kinds of great compassion. Of the unenlightened kind, we develop great compassion if we're on the Mahayana path before we even have a direct perception of emptiness. So the two kinds of great compassion are wanting other people to be separated from suffering. And that's the wish we develop. We wish that other people didn't suffer. We know what our suffering is like. And we, when we enter the path, we generate renunciation, meaning I'm fed up with that. I don't want it anymore. I'm going to do something about it. And then this great compassion is, and I want other people to not suffer as well. And then the second kind of great compassion, or the second part of it, is wanting to be the one who helps all these other people, even if nobody helps you do it. And this is the really telling part of great compassion of a bodhisattva. You take personal responsibility. I will see to it that I remove everybody else from suffering, even if I have to do it by myself alone. Very important thing here. Now, what's the difference between Nyingje and Tukje? We've talked about it. The Abhidharma gives eight different qualities that differentiate between Nyingje, which is sort of the common great compassion, and Tukje, which is the honorific for great compassion. We're not going to go into that stuff in the Abhidharma, but briefly, there are Hinayana and Mahayana forms of great compassion. There's a great compassion in the lower school, and it centers around wanting others to not suffer. People in the lower schools on the Hinayana path do indeed have compassion. You know, parents don't want their children to suffer. You know, spouses don't want each other to suffer. And they extend it to other people. They don't want people to suffer. And that's the great compassion in those schools. But in the Mahayana vehicle, we want to be the ones to help others eliminate their suffering. Now, some people claim that great compassion is not taught in the Hinayana schools. It is taught. You know, it's in the Abhidharma, in the scriptures of the lower schools. And the Abhidharma also describes bodhisattvas. It's just that the people in the lower schools don't think that they can become bodhisattvas. They know what they are, but they don't think they can do it. They don't have the capacity to do that. They do have the capacity to eliminate their own suffering. And for them, that's just fine. Now, how long does it take to achieve the great compassion of a Buddha? Well, it takes, according to the scriptures, three great eons, sometimes called three countless eons. Countless is a number in the Hindu system that stands for a one with 60 zeros behind it. It is their highest number. Before the numbering system was developed, the kind that you write down with ones and zeros or one through nine and so forth, before that was developed, people had names for numbers. I mean, we have names for numbers too. 1,000, for example, is the name for the value 1,000. So countless was the name for the value of a one with 60 zeros behind it. So three of those countless eons, where an eon itself is billions and billions and billions of years, okay, to achieve the great compassion of a Buddha, meaning from the time you get on the path until you become a Buddha, it takes three great eons, long time. Now, you might encounter a question in your homework that's something like, which of the four reasonings relates to the perfected thought and which to the perfected action? Well, the reasoning of great compassion is the one that relates to perfected thought. This is what leads to Buddhahood. Great compassion is what leads to Buddhahood, or to perfect, correct thought. All right? And the reasoning of the teacher would be the reasoning of perfected action. What does a Buddha do? He teaches perfected action. And then there's another question. You might find something, you know, like, what are the four reasonings relates to the culmination of one's own goals, and which is the culmination of others' goals? So the reasoning of having gone to bliss is the culmination of one's own goals. This is the destruction of all bad qualities and the realization of all things, you know, and that's our goal as bodhisattvas. We want to reach Buddhahood. We want to go to bliss. Why do we want that? So that we can help everybody else. So really, going to bliss is the culmination of our own goals as bodhisattvas. We want to become Buddhas. And then which is the culmination of other goals? Well, that's the reasoning of the protector. You know, here we protect other beings. We help them to reach their own goals. How do we do that? By teaching them. Now, why did we go through these reasonings? Why did Master Dignaga go through them? The Charvakas, which were a non-Hindu school, I think, in ancient India, claimed that there are no past lives. And we talked about this in the first class. Therefore, one cannot develop great compassion over many lives. If there are no past lives, then of course there cannot be any future lives either. The life we're in, if there are past lives, would be a future life for one of those past lives. But if there are no past lives, then the one we're in is probably the only one that we're ever going to have. And if that's true, then it's not possible to develop great compassion over many lives. Now, the Charvakas probably extended this to claim that one cannot achieve great compassion. I don't think they talked about great compassion. But if they did, they would have extended their claim that there's no past or future lives to say that one cannot develop great compassion. Part of their philosophy is that the mind depends on the body. Therefore, when we die, the mind dies too. And they give three reasons why the mind depends on the body. The first reason is that the mind is a quality of the body, in the same way that the ability to make a person drunk is a quality of alcohol, that kind of relationship. The second reason they gave is mind is by nature dependent on the body, in the way that a design that you put on a wall is dependent on the wall. You know, when Leonardo da Vinci, you know, did paintings on walls, made frescoes, you know, he put the design on the wall. So that painting, that design is dependent on the wall. The one you would be looking at is dependent on the wall. And that relationship is the same thing as the mind is by nature dependent on the body. The mind can't be there unless there's a body. And the third reason they give is the mind is a result of the body in the way that light is the result of a lamp. Now, the view that was prevalent in the Charvakas, the view of the Charvakas was present at the time of Master Dharmakirti. So he set about proving to them that past lives, it did exist, so he could prove that bodhicitta develops over a long period of time. Why did he have to prove that? Because that is what Lord Buddha said in some of the sutras. It takes a long time. So this is a really kind of quick overview of these four reasonings about how one becomes a Buddha, and that it takes time to do that. So I don't know whether Master Dignaga was successful in proving to the Charvakas that there were past and future lives. He probably was to some of them. But it's in there to prove to us so that we can accept it by going through these reasonings. If we go over and over and over them, we can begin to accept at a deep level that there are, in fact, past and future lives. And in addition to that, the way to reach Buddhahood is to develop great compassion. Now, about those three countless eons, you ought to think that at least two of those countless eons is behind you already, and probably much, much more than that. In order to be able to receive teachings like this, you have to be very, very far along the path and have studied this kind of stuff in many, many lifetimes before. You just aren't aware of them all right now, but we're constantly gathering karma so that we can progress along the path. And you're at the point now where you're receiving teachings that hopefully will allow you to have a direct perception of emptiness. That's the goal, basically, of all the ACI and Diamond Mountain efforts that we have, is to develop a direct perception of emptiness in people. So that's the class for today. If any of you haven't fallen over in a dead faint, it's time for questions.
I have a question because of these eons. What was before these three eons?
The eon?
Yes.
Oh, well, there are universes come into existence, they abide for a time, and they go out of existence, and then there's a period where there's nothing. And this keeps happening over and over. And there's billions of universes, not just the one we know about.
Okay.
So that's the way it works.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
This is described in the Abhidharma Kosha too.
Mm-hmm.
question from Berlin. What makes you say that we are already in the third eon?
Whoever's speaking, I can't hear you.
Yeah. Okay, this is Christian from Berlin. Can you hear me?
There you go. Yep.
You said that we are most probably already in the third eon, so left two eons behind us.
Yep.
Yeah. What makes you say that?
What makes me say that is because my teacher told me that over and over again, and his teacher the same way, that in order to be, to have the karma, to receive teachings like this, requires lots and lots of paying attention to teachings in the past, really, and doing something about it. We're very far along the path. We have to think that way. That, you know, you're one of a fraction of a percent of people who receive these kind of teachings on this planet right now. And you just have to reflect on why is that possible? It isn't random. There has to be a cause for it. I mean, that's one of the bases of karma, even though we haven't gotten to the karma class yet. There's got to be a reason for it. The result, receiving these teachings, has to be similar to the cause of having done that. So the cause has to have been that you've received these teachings before and done something about them. Maybe not these exact teachings, or maybe you have, you know, and each successive life they become clearer and clearer and clearer until you reach a point where you receive the teachings from somebody who's had a direct perception of emptiness. That somebody's not me. That somebody is Geshe Michael Roach. Okay. And then he received them from people who'd had direct perceptions of emptiness and so on, clear back to Lord Buddha. And that's the way you think. Right now, I don't know that you can put that together in a logical way that satisfies you. But over the course of the next, what is it? Well, the rest of the ACI courses, you'll develop a bigger and bigger appreciation of why that has to be the case.
Yes, Martin again.
Mm-hmm.
The first Buddha, did he manage you with great compassion only because he hadn't had the teaching?
Well, he had the teachings. There is no first Buddha because there has to be a cause for Buddhahood. And that would be a previous Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
In any particular mind stream, like Shakyamuni Buddha, the Buddha of this,
that
we know about, mm-hmm. It is said that he was already enlightened when he came here and that he went through the process of becoming enlightened just to show us how it's done. One of his disciples, Maitreya, will be the Maitreya is the next Buddha that will come in either 2500 or 20,000 years, depending on which text you read.
Mm-hmm.
And now he was probably enlightened while he was the disciple of Lord Buddha. He didn't manifest that for us, or he might have been before. But basically, how did the first Buddha appear? There was no first Buddha.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Yes. Christian again from Berlin. Can you hear me, sir? Can you hear me? Can you
understand me?
You just said there was no first Buddha. Of course, I mean, you know that we are now thinking about this. Can you? It's just too much for my mind. This is going to take a long time to understand.
You were cutting out on me there.
Excuse me?
I couldn't hear all the question.
Okay. You just said that there was no first Buddha.
Right. So can you don't understand that?
Of course, I do not understand that. Do you?
I do. Logically, I don't think I've got it down deep very good yet, but here's what I do. Time is a construct very conventional of our reality. Arya Nagarjuna, in his great book that sort of got this Mahayana path started again, took time as an example of something that does not exist from its own side. So there's no such thing as time as we understand it from its own side. Like everything else, nothing has a nature of its own. Time is something we have developed an idea of to try to put things in order. It does work. But in physics, physics doesn't know what to do with time, really. It's included in equations simply as a duration. There's no constant about how fast time moves. There's nothing else about it. It's just sort of there. If you go into something, you know, that physicists now describe as the space-time continuum, time is very much tied up with space in ways that's very difficult for non-physicists to understand. So this idea of being first is very much tied up with time. And I think first is really not a quality of time.
Yeah.
If you get down to it.
Super. Thank you.
Yeah.
Very good. No, I'm not lost anymore. At least I have like a small straw.
All right.
Thank you.
One of the interesting things about studying Buddhism is that it just totally turns your world upside down, and which is a good thing, if you can handle it. Okay, well, if there's nothing else.
I have one more, but it's not about this lesson. It's about valid perception. Is it possible?
Sure.
We have 99% valid perceptions. What is with dreams? Is it?
Oh. Dreams are valid perceptions in the sense that when you're having them, it's not possible to have any other kind of perception. Therefore, in the highest school now, they're valid.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
They are caused by senses. We're having the dreams, it seems as though we're just kind of in our normal world, right?
Mm-hmm.
We see things, but what we're seeing is not from our eye sense consciousness. It's from the mental sense. It's not even like a memory so much, but it's generated there.
Uh-huh.
We hear people talking, but it's not from our air sense consciousnesses because there's nobody around when that's happening. Our eyes are closed when we're asleep, so we're actually not seeing anything with our eye sense consciousness. And so on.
Okay.
Maybe I should say with our eye sense organs and ear sense organs, is karma evident to present an image in our eye consciousness? I don't know. Maybe. I kind of doubt it. Since the eye consciousness is empowered by the eye sense organ, according to perceptual theory in Buddhism. So dreams are valid perceptions in the sense of having them.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, I wish you a pleasant week.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, wonderful.
Danke, Brigitte. Tschüss.